Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
Hey, we had an amazing trip this last week, and it was so great to get out there and see everybody again and get back to the world of the living. I want to thank NEPI, the New England Paranormal Investigator Group that hosted it with Dana and Chris Wingard, for having us out at Gettysburg. That was so much fun. Man, I can't even say how much fun that was.
Yeah.
Just so great to connect with Stacy Jones, the ghost cop, Jason Hawes, and Chris Fleming, Jeff Belanger, Aaron Sagers, Eric Altman, our Monster Watch specialist, the good boys from, good God, my mind just went blank from
Tennessee Wraith Chasers.
Yes, Tennessee Wraith Chasers. Okay. I was like, not Deep South Paranormal. Nope. They're the guys that were there always in the past.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, we had the Tennessee Wraith Chasers out and had a great time. My next event, I believe I will be out at the Belvoir Winery, Amy Bruni's Strange Escapes event in July. I'm looking forward to doing that and getting out and having some fun. Then August, I'll be out in Dallas with Shane and Cindy at the Texas Para Unicon, Michigan Para Unicon program. Well, they're not the Unicon, but the Michigan Paracon is in their, I think, 11th or 12th season. That's August of this year. The New Jersey Paracon is taking place in September. I'm literally booked through something every month, a couple times a month. So come on out and see us. We're going to have a great time, have a lot of fun. And you can find all that information over at darknessevents.com. All right, Tim, in getting out, you had a chance to do conspiracy theory talk and chat with a lot of people that came by the tables. I don't know if you want to mention real quickly, you do have a new item, a cool little collectible, and you're going to have it up on your Facebook page, right? So people can see it.
We'll have it on social media and we'll connect back to the manufacturer as well. We have Darkness Radio talking boards in two different styles. We have a sunburst style and what we call the Minnesota Wild style, which shows Dave and I afraid of everything in the outdoors, as it should be. Because
that one's more caricature-y.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's a lot of fun little imagery on it. The other one is Scully in the middle and then actual images of Tim and I. So it's both of them are really beautifully made.
Yep. And we had them at the show and they did extremely well. So we're going to try them out online. So look for those details here in the future. Just keep focused on my social media and we'll announce in the days to come when that will hit the internet, so to speak, and you can take a look at them for yourself.
Right, and there's mini boards and big boards, so it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Keep checking that out. Let's get started. You know, was it a week or so ago in the news we were talking about werewolf sightings and strange news stories, and I thought, well, gosh, we should just reach out to this author and talk to him about his book. And, you know, I go searching and sure enough, A Travel Guide, Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, Inside the Wold Newton Triangle, New Werewolf Update Edition. And I'm like, I'm in. Let's get this moving. So I reached out and thankfully our friend Michelle Freed, who, of course, helped book guests for me on Midnight in the Desert, works with Mr. Christian, and she was able to help connect us. So ladies and gentlemen, help us welcome to the Darkness on the Edge of Town paranormal radio show, Charles Christian. Thank you so much for being here with us today, sir.
It's my pleasure. My pleasure.
You know, this was a great little find for us. I love when we can find a place that a book written about an entire area where it's a wide swath of strange activity. And I'd never heard of the Wold Newton Triangle before. So this is going to, I think, be mostly new for all of our audience. Did you live or do you live in that vicinity, or is it an area you're safely away from?
I used to live there when I was a child and teenager and basically till I left home. So I traveled through it and I had a friend who was a farmer's son who lived around there. So we traveled all around that area. But it was really only much later that I started to remember some of the tales and put one and one together and start getting three and starting to look into it in more detail.
That's realized, the kind of science that makes the supernatural what it is, right?
One exactly,
and one and coming
exactly.
up with three. And it's that unknown quantitative. It's that what exactly are we dealing with? But as you look back, do you remember hearing these weird stories when you were a kid in that vicinity? Where was it a big place of legend and lore, or was it always one that was kind of that dirty little secret, the things people only whispered about politely behind closed doors?
No, some of them were quite well known, but it's one of those parts of the country. You said you'd never heard of it before, but it's a little bit of England that all the main roads bypass by a long way. And unless you happen to be needing to get from one part of that area to another, you could quite happily go all your life and not be any the wiser that the place existed.
But that's pretty strange, considering, you know, there are all of the Bridgewater Triangle in the United States, the Bermuda Triangle. You know, you hear of all these strange places that have so many bizarre stories associated with them, and they're pretty famous. But then here you've got a location right in your own backyard that many people aren't even aware of.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was, as I said, it was only with hindsight, as I started putting together, I realized there was so much there. And I christened it the Wold Newton Triangle because, number one, it actually has three sides to it. And number two, everybody loves a triangle.
Right.
The Bermuda Triangle. You know,
the most terrifying of all geometric shapes is, of course, the triangle. We know that, right?
Well, exactly. You know, it wouldn't really work if it was the Wold Newton quadrahedron or something.
Exactly.
What? So it appealed. But to go back to the first question about the stories, one of them was very well known about a stately home, as in an old mansion that the aristocracy used to live in, and a screaming skull that's associated with it, with one of the former occupants of the house had their head buried in a secret compartment, and whenever anybody tried to move the skull, thinking, ugh, it's a bit disgusting having this skull here, it would scream and make a noise and create chaos in the house. And that's very well known. It is, you know, it's on the sort of, if you like, on the tourist map, although the skull is hidden away and the story is now only the owner and his heir know its exact location. It's said to be behind paneling on a staircase. Though during up to the middle of the 19th century, so, you know, 150 years ago, it was still kept on a table in the front hall, so you couldn't actually miss it when you went in there. But
why? Now, do we have any idea the backstory of this head and its history and why it would be so upset to be removed to begin with?
Yeah, the story is that the owner of the house had three daughters, and he was having this big new house built. We're talking here the early 17th century. And it was going to be a big state-of-the-art house. And the family were all very excited about moving there from their previous house. And one of the daughters was, unfortunately, we'd nowadays say, was the victim of a violent mugging. She was attacked, and she subsequently died from her injuries. Ooh. So she never got to live to see the new house. However, before she died, she said, I want to be part of the new house. I want my head to be buried in the house, which naturally the family thought, you know, the poor girl, you know, she's delirious. She's suffering from her injuries. So they buried her when she died. They buried her the normal way, complete with her head in a grave. And that was the end of it. But when they eventually moved into the new house, there started to be all manner of strange disturbances and noises, and generally felt that the house was haunted. And of course, they had in mind that the daughter, known later as Old Nancy or Old Nance, they had in mind that the daughter might be something connected with her. So they had the body exhumed, and found that while most of the body was still in its normal state of decomposition, the skull had miraculously separated itself from the rest of the body and had already turned into a fleshless skull. So they decided, well, you know, this must be divine intervention. And, you know, we're talking of the 1600s here, the early 17th century, when people right. believed in divine intervention and things of that nature. So they said, well, you know, this is a sign that the head, that she really wants her head to be there. So they moved the head into the house. And following that, their generally peace and calm returned. But at various times over the next 100 years or so, various well-meaning people thought, well, let's move the head and it's a bit yucky and let's try and get rid of it. And whenever they removed the house, removed the skull from the house, chaos ensued. There's a story that one maid threw it out of a window where it landed on a pile of horse hay and none of the horses would go past it. So every time the skull was removed, chaos ensued. Every time the skull was put back in its place, everything went back to normal. So the tradition grew up that, yes, we will keep this head here. And the tradition has continued. And I say it was on public display, or at least, you know, openly visible up until the middle of the 19th century. And then, I suppose, with Victorian sensibilities, they were a bit prudish, the Victorians. The head was put away in a cupboard somewhere, still within the house, but no longer on public display. But supposedly is still there in this house to the day.
Oh, that's remarkable. Right. I mean, yeah. it shows kind of the provincial attitude and the shift towards what death is and the way we accept it, right? With, you know, skulls just being kind of put out on display. And sometimes this was the remembrance of family members. Obviously, you go to Paris and the catacombs, the displays there were done in beautiful honor and respect, but a way to contain all the bodies and everything that took place. And in modern society, you wouldn't even think we would do something like that, right? I mean, it would be considered, you know, a travesty and a horror scene to compiling bones and having skulls displayed.
Well, you'd probably be arrested. There's probably a law against it. The first sort of, you know, misuse of dead bodies and things. There are controls on it. But yeah, you're right. And I mean, I think it's the Capuchins, a group of monks. They have a chapel in Rome, and that is they've taken all the bones and made them into ornaments and sort of decorated the walls with them. So, you know, you will have all the leg bones like a sun ray around a skull and things. And that is, by modern standards, completely gross. But, you know, was seen to be the thing that you did in those days. But it may well be a little an English tradition, the heads. There's several other houses that have heads concealed within them, or a tradition of them. And
now you say a tradition of them. I mean, is there a call for that? I mean, obviously we know wakes came from, you know, having people come in and realize, oh, the reason we send flowers to wakes is because they were not preserved and the bodies began to stink and decay and the flowers would be there to cover it. And we did a wake for 3 days to give the spirit time to prove that it was dead, right? So that we didn't prematurely bury these figures and people. So I know where a lot of those traditions come from, but the idea of, and again, saints, I know the idea of carrying a piece of a saint into battle was often considered lucky, and those of you that had the better part of the saint would probably be the more successful in doing this. But where did the concept or kind of the legacy of keeping the head?
Well, again, a lot of them, the tales are rather lost in time. But what's intriguing is that it's always perceived as lucky to have the head there. Whereas, you know, with modern sensibilities, you might think, oh, we're cursed. We've got to have a a disembodied skull with us in the house. English tradition, the older tradition, was that there was some form of luck, and that as long as the head was there, the family fortunes would fare all right. And as with this particular one, the house is called Burton Agnes, and it's near a town called Bridlington, and you can go there and visit and look around the place, but you can't see the head anymore. But, you know, places like that. The reverse became the tradition, that it was good luck to have the skull there rather than bad luck. But you're right about the saints' bones. And I mean, there was a huge industry almost in the medieval times, you know, before the Reformation, in a trade in saints' holy relics. And some of the relics you hear are, you know, quite bizarre. You know, if you add them together, there's some saints. I think St. James is one of them. If you go by what the various churches claim, he had at least four heads, because there's four of them who claim he had got his skull.
Well, that's why he's a saint, right? I mean,
exactly. Yes.
Charles, you have to have something that puts you into that zone, and apparently having multiple heads would be one that would fit that. What about the concept of and I've heard this more in Europe than in the United States, although there have been some houses where it has been discovered, but the burying of people in the walls of homes and, you know, the castles and such. What do we know about
that? They do crop up. I mean, it's an odd thing that bodies are found in odd places, you know, typically when somebody is doing major renovation works and they find a body is walled up there. Again, I think it must be the tradition of a form of home burial. Not all of them, as you know, literature and movies would have it, that they were all wicked nuns and wicked monks who were walled up for their sins. But that really wasn't very, you know, is a very rare thing, and clearly didn't happen in places where there were no monks and no nuns or anything. But I think it's a similar thing, that somebody was so attached to the property that they wanted to be there. I mean, when you go back even further in time, then you had this idea of the spirit of the dead person would protect the house.
Right.
And that goes right back to the Romans, where they would bury somebody dead, but, you know, sometimes it was children, sometimes it was a slave or whatever, in the foundations of a building or the foundations of a bridge, on the belief that the spirit of the dead person would protect the building. I don't think we're really getting that in England, because once the Romans are over, we're into Christian traditions, and doesn't really sit well with the prevailing orthodoxy of the, you know, the medieval period. Mm-hmm. But I think it is the idea of people wanting to be buried where they were happiest in their life and maintain their connection with it. And I say, before the stricter burial laws came in, you could do that.
Well, there are many of those old houses throughout Europe and throughout the United States where the family members did bury, and they buried them usually close to the home have that kind of sense of staying near the place that they, you know, sweated blood and tears for to keep it alive. Even, you know, doing the Holzer Files TV show, one of the families, this house that we went to, this woman's spirit is waiting for her children to return. And one of the children that grew up in that house and dealt with these ghosts has felt this pull for years. And you know, he's a former White House usher now, and quite an amazing life. And when he dies, he wants to be returned to that property. And that says something, right? I mean, that's pretty, you know, I guess some people feel that call and tie to that land.
Mm. It's certainly a thing in some farming communities. Then the village next to where I'm living now, there's a property there where there are two tombs in the garden of previous members of the family who were farmers there and died and were buried on their own property. So, you know, that's a relatively modern tradition. You know, we're talking with those graves, 1950s, you know, so it's a strong connection people have to properties. And, you know, you can imagine it where you are happiest in your life. You'd like to be there in your afterlife, I suppose.
Agreed. Now, do you believe that it's these body parts that lead to hauntings? Is it the spirit of that person that's still tied to it? Or are there other spirits that seem to be trying to invade the property and the bodies and relics are there to protect the home from that kind of energy?
I think the spirits arise when they are disturbed or moved. I don't think they're there specifically as protection against other darker forces. I think it's more that all the time you don't disturb those bodies, they will not cause any problems and they will not haunt. But of course, inevitably, they do get disturbed, and you know, the burial records get lost, which is another reason why they turn up in odd places, because no one's got a trace of them. You know, in the UK, for example, huge numbers of documents were lost in the Second World War with bombing raids and buildings being destroyed and public record offices being destroyed. And, you know, they were in town halls and municipal buildings. And so there are large gaps and people just don't know where they are. And then it comes as a bit of a shock when they are found. And but I say, I don't think certainly in modern Christian times, as opposed to pagan times, anybody was buried to keep away dark forces. I think out of following the will of the deceased that they wanted to be buried there. And obviously, if you then renege on that arrangement, then they're unhappy and then they cause you problems.
Now, talk to me, if you would, about the fact that, you know, a lot of things we know are from fables and folklore. There's usually a story behind why these things are told, to keep the kids from going into the forest where they could get attacked by a real wolf, by staying away from the water's edge where they might slip in and drown, right? Obviously, yes. We create monsters and myths and ghosts stories in folklore to be protective. But where do we start to see a line of separation? It says that a lot of legends are built on reality. Where do you feel that comes in, especially in an area that's so odd and has so many strange things, from werewolves, zombies, vampires, fairy folk, headless ghosts, screaming skulls? I mean, there seems to be a lot to unpack there.
Well, there is. I think one of the reasons is it's a rural area that's relatively untouched. And so older local traditions have lasted longer. You know, the whole area hasn't been redeveloped. And lots of newcomers have come in who know nothing of the traditions, and the older people have moved away or whatever. So I think that the stories have been able to live on, whereas in other places they might have been forgotten and, you know, pushed aside as just nonsense. I mean, I'm a great believer, like you were saying, that when you're talking about folklore, no matter how weird the story is, there is usually some element of logic or truth behind it. It's just that over time, that's been forgotten and been slightly changed. I mean, as you said, there's this whole range of what we call nursery bogies, the terrible threats you give to children that, you know, if you go there, that's, as you say, go near the water and fall in England, one of the creatures is called Jenny Greenteeth, and she lurks in the rushes, and she will grab naughty children and drag them in and drown them. And certainly I had a grandmother who used to tell me that when we were in parks and things, and I was playing too near the water. And that, you know, you can understand where that came from. And then separately, a tradition has grown up that there really is something called Jenny Greenteeth, who is this hideous, green, long-toothed, long-clawed aquatic creature. But other ones, again, I say it's a combination of things. I mean, one of my favorite examples are dragons. Now, you know, dragons are a global phenomenon. Where did they come from? Because obviously nobody has any records in modern times of fire-breathing creatures. But, you know, it's a universal myth. And I think one of the explanations are big, scary creatures that really do exist in the world, but the descriptions of them in pre-literate times, pre-photographic times, was always rather cockeyed. And so tales of crocodiles, and certainly saltwater crocodiles, can grow to be huge and very scary. Creatures like the Komodo dragon in the Far East, all manner of things like that. You can imagine that people traveling through those areas and encountering them and coming back to their hometowns would tell these tales, and then somebody else would pass on the tale. Ooh, you know, he's just back from China, and he saw this creature, and it ran along the ground. It had a long tail and big teeth and things. And you can see how that goes. And I think the other thing is dinosaur bones. People were digging them up. People have been mining, for one thing or another, for 2,000 years at least. Imagine you are a illiterate peasant in the 12th century, and you dig up the skull of a Tyrannosaurus rex, and the only literate person in your village would be the parson, the priest, and that the priest would definitely say, you know, that is one of the beasts from the Bible. That's the remains of a dragon. And you could see how it would go. And indeed, there are.
Well, listen, as an illiterate rube in the 21st century, if I dug up a T-Rex skull, I'd probably think it was a dragon head. But you're right. I mean, especially in the right back in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, we're finding unearthed natural phenomena of dinosaur bones now. Back then, when there was still not as much dirt on top and garbage there, right? Maybe they would come across a full or a partial structure of bones sticking out of the earth. That what else would you believe it to be?
Well, exactly. And, you know, you would go to your normal, we're talking here, Western Europe, you'd go to your normal, your source of information, and the most learned person, say, would be the priest. And the priest would in turn go to the Bible. And there was very much a belief in those days that if it wasn't in that, everything in the Bible was true, and the Bible talks of the beast of the apocalypse and the of dragons and various creatures of that nature, so, and of demons, and so they say, you know, these are demonic, or these are dragon bones, and so the, you know, the tale would continue, and it would be added to by the fact that people had seen things like crocodiles and hippopotamuses and other large creatures, and it would add fuel to it. Indeed, there is a number of churches and places where they have still hanging up bones that are said to be dragon bones, and, you know, there's a whole myth that, you know, a certain knight in the olden days slayed this beast. And, you know, modern scientists have sadly come along and said, actually, no, those are whale bones, or those are
Stupid dinosaur scientists. Why do they always have to ruin stuff for the rest of us?
Well, I mean, again, you know, you get all these tales these days of sea monsters being washed up, which scientists can show are actually decomposed sea creatures, you know, whales, etc., where parts of the flesh have gone away and are left the long neck bones and the head and the fins. And, you know, you could look at it and think, well, that looks like a plesiosaur or something. You know, it looks like a traditional sea monster.
They just uncovered another, like the coelacanth before it, the fish that they thought was dead for millions of years. They've just now uncovered another ancient fish that they believe died out like 20 million years ago. So there, you know, the fact that there still may be things in the deep ocean that we're not familiar with haven't seen is ridiculous to think it wouldn't exist out there. People might still come into contact.
Well, I mean, the giant squid was thought to be a myth until relatively recently because they live in such deep waters that their bodies are never seen, you know, and it's only relatively recently that people have been recovering the remains of them and finding that these tales of enormous squid are actually true. But, you know, and as you say, what else is down there? Sharks are a good example. They have lived as a species for millions of years, pretty much unchanged. They got the model right. Crocodiles have a very long tradition as well. There were crocodiles at the time of the dinosaurs that have become extinct, but the families basically lived on through millions and millions of years without much change. I always feel sorry for dinosaurs because everybody reckons now they've turned into chickens basically and sort of devolved the other way into birds. But, the likes of sharks and crocodiles, they've been around unchanged for so long. So what else has been around unchanged for so long? But we just haven't discovered it yet because, what is it? 3/4 of the world is covered in water, and there's some very deep bits. And
talking about strange creatures like this, I want to discuss the werewolf. And let's do this. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got more to discuss, a lot more. We're just getting started with our weird wolds and finding out the strange stories surrounding that area. We've got a link for the book on today's program guide, so make sure you check for that as well. We'll be back with Charles Christian, Tim Dennis, and myself, Dave Schrader, right here on Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for tuning in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. All right, Christian, Charles Christian, our guest, a travel guide, Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, inside the Wold Newton Triangle. We have a link up for the new Werewolf Update Edition. I want to talk werewolves. I love werewolves. That's always been my favorite kind of fantastic creature of Universal Studio history. And then imagine my surprise to start reading and see that throughout European culture, there was a very strong belief in lycanthropy and werewolves and so many different historic accounts of these creatures existing. I would love to know more about this. So please enlighten us. And I guess there's even more recent sightings of these alleged beasts.
Well, there are. And that's why the update is there was an incident about 5 years ago now when people in a town called Hull, which is about 20 miles south of the Wold Newton Triangle, it's the nearest city around there, people were reporting seeing what they thought was a werewolf. And I got involved because I'd written the book about it, and a journalist phoned me up and said, "What do you think about it?" And I rather flippantly said, "I thought it was Old Stinker," which is the name of the werewolf that used to be in the Old Newton Triangle area, and that it's possibly what Old Stinker's come back from the undead and is back to haunt us. But
or perhaps a new Old Stinker, right? Is well, it a generational exactly. creature? What do we know about this?
Yeah, well, again, this was one of the stories I actually grew up with. There was a legend that in a town called Folkton, there had been in medieval times a werewolf known as Old Stinker, because apparently its breath was putrid, because it would eat carrion and it would dig up tombs and eat the bodies inside. That it haunted the area, and the story was that it was thought to be a shape-shifting werewolf, that it took the form of a human during the day and then during the night changed into a werewolf, or changed into a wolf, and led a pack of wolves, normal wolves, who would prey on travelers in the area. And I say the theory was that, well, if you like, the panicky rumor was that when the wolf was in its human form, it would go around the local towns and markets and would hear news and gather that trader over there, that merchant over there, is going to be making his way home this evening, heading out of the village and be traveling across the country. And so would then pounce on the traveler at night and got its information there. But I say, the more I dug again, once again, this is really what first got me into the idea that no matter how weird the story is, there may well be some element of truth that first started it. And if we go back to long, long time ago, the 10th century, so we're talking before the Norman Conquest, money was left to build a hostel on part of the Weird Worlds area, specifically so that travelers could take shelter there at night so they wouldn't be attacked by the wolves that were prowling the area. So you basically had real wolves creating such a problem that you needed somewhere for people to take shelter. So, you know, the charter says, lest they be eaten by the wolves. And indeed, I think it was January in the Saxon calendar, Anglo-Saxon calendars, again, pre the Norman Conquest, used to be called Wolf Month, because that's when the wolves were the biggest problem. The weather was the coldest, the crops were all gone, all the animals had been taken into shelter because the hills around that area were too bleak. So the wolves would come down into the villages and they would attack people, they would attack any livestock, and they would also dig up bodies that are, you know, freshly buried bodies for the flesh, you know, as carrion. So you can see that going way back, there is a tradition that wolves were despoilers of the dead, if you like, and no respect for living creatures, and very dangerous. And of course,
is funny, considering that, if I understand this correctly, and the stories of Burke and Hare and such, right? It was grave robbing was illegal. That's why they would take the clothes and jewelry and everything off and leave it in the coffin and only steal the cadavers, because there was really no law regarding the body. But the personal effects were what really kind of got people in trouble at the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is true. I mean, but there again, we are talking that's late 18th century, early 19th century. So, you know, 800 years difference.
Right.
But I say, you've got this. And okay, once again, going back to our medieval peasant, we now understand or have an understanding of animal behavior. And we know the way wolves naturally work in a wolf pack and have some form of ability to signal to each other, and they will, you know, corner a prey. Once again, if you didn't understand that and most people wouldn't. You'd have thought there was something slightly supernatural and spooky about the fact that these wolves seem to be able to communicate and work as a group. Now, that's sort of, if you like, the very basics of it. But then we have this peculiarity that, again, I'm mentioning 1066 again, which is, you know, the Normans came over and killed King Harold. But shortly before the Battle of Hastings, there was the Battle of Stamford Bridge, which was the last attempt by the Vikings to invade England. And they landed at a town called Scarborough, which is just marginally north of the Weird Wolds, the Wold-Newton Triangle. And some of them sailed off to Stamford Bridge by boat, but others headed inland. And it's known that the Vikings of that time, we've all heard of berserkers, you know, crazed, bloodthirsty warriors that appear to be impervious to attack and go into battle just wearing a bearskin of some sort.
Right.
And, you know, anybody who's seen the movie The Vikings will know this, and indeed some of the characters in 1066 and the Battle of Stamford Bridge crop up in the saga. But there were also Vikings who wore the skin of wolves, and they would go into battle with a wolf skin over their head, and, you know, they'd create it so that it covered the backs, and the skull part, the muzzle and things would be over the front of the man's jaw, over the front of the man's face. And again, you're hiding in a barn or under your bed or behind a rock, hoping that these Vikings aren't going to do something horrible to you. And you see these bloodthirsty men going past that they're covered in blood and they're wearing wolf skins. You know, are they a man in a wolf skin, or is it a wolf that is part man or whatever? And there is a theory that this was one of the first origins in Europe of the concept of the werewolf, that it was mistaking these wolf-like fighters. So, you know, that I think is one of the historical angles to it, that there may well have been this fear and belief that the wolves and men were the same thing, and they were some kind of shape changer. And I mean, that's before we get into lycanthropy and the fact that there are people out there who genuinely believe they are wolves and behave like wolves. And when you read the European witchcraft trials of the 16th and 17th century, along with witches, and obviously put the usual caveat in here, most of them were not witches at all. They were just people who'd been accused of being witches. Just unfortunate old ladies, a lot of them. But there were people who were also being put on trial and executed for being werewolves. And, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, we know they were mentally ill and they were suffering from lycanthropy, and they thought they were werewolves. And some of them would attack people and savage them as if they were a wolf. You know, it was the belief was so strong that they had that's what they thought they were. So
it's unbelievable, right, to think that. But yet, what do you make of current stories, Charles, of these like the Beast of Bray Road in the United States here, these large dog-like creatures that are currently being seen, and they're not just being seen by guys swilling moonshine in the woods, right? They're being seen by workers, by police officers, by people that you would think have a decent reputation and you could trust what they're saying when it comes to an eyewitness account.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say on that one, because again, we have in the UK, it tends to be big cats that are what we see more of. But Yeah, we do have these tales of large dog-like creatures. And I think the jury is out on whether they are some kind of cryptozoological paranormal creature, or whether they are abandoned, turned feral, large dogs. You know, there's an awful lot of exotic breeds that people import and have, you know, sort of attack dogs, if you like, that are let loose because they become uncontrollable.
Right, you know, but running on their hind legs through the woods, that's where it starts to get a little weird.
Yeah. I mean, you know, animals can run on their hind, dogs can run on their hind legs. And if you've got something like a wolf that's standing on its hind legs, leaping up, is a very tall looking creature. You know, and it would be bigger than most people, a wolf fully stretched out. You know, so is it real or is it supernatural? I think it's a mixture of the two, that, you know, there is one line where there is a logical solution for it. Yeah, it's a wild dog of some sort that's on the prowl. And I definitely think from my werewolf hunt in Hull, which, you know, followed the book, that's what the source of it was, and that it was purely people misinterpreting, not being able to work what it was, a very large, you know, something like a Malamute or Husky type dog, which is the size of a wolf. I think in some instances there is a simple explanation, but in others, it's not. But there again, is it that, or is it one point we were going back to earlier? Is it a natural creature that's just not been recorded and is living in a wild population and, you know, hasn't been neatly recorded by science, and so we don't know what it looks like, and so people are glimpsing this? Because, of course, we've got this continuing trend that people are pushing more and more into nature. You know, the need for housing to expand, communities are getting larger, people are building where previously they didn't build before. We are displacing natural populations, and we're flushing out, if you like, creatures that previously have been hidden away from us.
It also makes me wonder, when you kind of look back into the legends and lores of things of witchcraft and the gypsies, there is a connection to the animal world quite strongly in that. And one of the, I'm sorry, I coughed there, so I muted, but one of the strange concepts is the familiar, or that the gypsy culture, the Wiccan culture, knows how to spiritually connect with animals. Do they, not necessarily shapeshift, but do they share consciousness with an animal and, you know, autonomously run that animal for a short period of time to do their bidding? Which sounds strange, I understand. But again, when you look into some of the historical significance of some of these folklores, it turns out there are nuggets of truth, you know, and things said. Manipulate a creature, and it's a forgotten art. Things that we, you know, don't know how to do now. Is it something that was prevalent back in the day in some cultures, like Native American, indigenous people cultures? You know, maybe they're still they still know that. I bring it up because I was actually at a bar, a Native American casino, and one of the elders was sitting down and had thrown back a few drinks, and we were talking about the paranormal, and I said, you know, I'm fascinated by the concept of shapeshifters and aliens and things. And he goes, you know, there's a lot to that. And like, that's all he got out. And suddenly we were surrounded by about five or six of the different employees of the casino, Native American culture, and they ushered him away quickly. And the one said, this is our culture's stories and beliefs, and we keep them very close. So please don't find us rude, but he's about to speak out of line, sharing information. And I was like, oh man, just, but what was uncanny to me is there was nobody around when he started speaking. And the minute he was ready to start revealing secrets, we were surrounded. So it's interesting to think, you know, boy, what do they know? What is it with their culture, that, you know, maybe there is some connectivity to the animals that they're able to do, or that we were able to do at one point.
I think that there's a lot in that. I mean, you only have to look at the way shepherds can train sheepdogs, and they can just control them by a whistle. This may be more of an English thing, but it's a big thing. And, you know, the shepherd stands at one end of the field and makes a whistling sound, and the sheepdog at the other end of the field is running backwards and forwards and moving the sheep around and herding them around and sending them on the way in the direction the shepherd wants them to go. And in the end, we'll get them into a pen so the shepherd can pen them in for the night. So there are those skills. And I mean, there's also a tradition starting to be seen. You hear the phrase horse whisperer or dog whisperer, somebody who seems to have a communication with a horse or a dog and can get them to do things that they naturally wouldn't do. And that seems very mysterious. Is it a special skill, or is it that the person can read the animal's signals and knows how to control it better? But yeah, I think there is a lot of that. And again, it's a bit like when people say, we don't know how they built the pyramids. It must have been the aliens. It's not that it was the aliens who came in. It's just that we've, in the modern times, have lost the secrets that some of these ancient things were built with. You know, their knowledge is lost to us. And how much other knowledge has been lost to us over the centuries? And how much knowledge is retained by communities that are, if you like, non-mainstream? So Native American is, to an extent, they still have their own culture and they still have their own communities that, to a considerable extent, are separate from, if you like, the mainstream. Gypsies, Romanies, again, they have their own culture. They are very closed. I mean, same thing, they're constantly persecuted, so they tend to cluster together, and they have their own secrets, and they have a long tradition of being able to work with animals and having an understanding, gypsies particularly, with horses. Again, and you know, they keep their secrets, they keep their cultural secrets, nobody talks about them. Is that what's going on there as well, that people have these ancient knowledges that they aren't sharing with the wider world? So anybody encountering them will regard them as mysterious and magical.
I'm fascinated by this. Now, let me ask, though, okay, if there's all this belief in these creatures, these, you know, from dragons to werewolves, was there a belief of why they existed? Were they nature's way of balancing humanity and the earth? And how do you stop them? How do you, you know, if a dragon were to come, what do you kill them with? What do you kill a werewolf? I know modern culture says a silver bullet's the only thing that'll really do it. But what do we know about some of the other legends and lore surrounding these mythical creatures?
Yeah, well, werewolves are interesting because a lot of what we regard as werewolf lore actually stems from the movies in the 1930s, The Werewolf of London and The Curse of the Wolfman, or is it The Wolfman of London and The Curse of the Wolfman, but the two Lon Chaney movies. And you know, the idea that you shoot that it prowls on a full moon and you shoot it with a silver bullet and the dead body then reverts to its human form. They were not associated with werewolves until those two movies came along. It's a bit like a lot of vampire lore is directly taken from Bram Stoker's Dracula. And the traditions that now everybody says, this is how you deal with them. No, you don't. But we just assume that's the way because that's what popular culture tells it was. If you go back to the time of the werewolf hunts and trials in Europe, where I say the werewolves were a lot bigger thing. That's what one of the things that intrigued me about Old Stinker is that England doesn't naturally have a werewolf culture. Old Stinker is actually the only one in the historical record. The Scottish have a form of werewolf, but down in England we only have Old Stinker in the records. That's what particularly intrigued me. But I say over in Europe, they very much regarded werewolves as essentially being a flesh and blood creature, albeit with some magical powers, and you hunted it down like any other flesh and blood creature, and you shot it, you stabbed it, you chopped its head off. You can find old woodcuts from the werewolf trials and the witch trials era of, you know, werewolves being hanged on the gallows and things. So it was very much seen as they were a flesh and blood creature, and it's a bit like the Arnold Schwarzenegger Predator movies. You know, if it bleeds, you can kill it, and that was very much the practical view they had on it.
Very cool. What about how did you kill a dragon? What was there ever a legend that went along with that?
Well, there's lots of ways. Some which are just strange and weird. Like if you put a virgin's girdle, which I think would be basically a belt around the dragon, it would become docile and you could then just run it through with a spear. And people like
Saint George. Wait a minute. So you could get close enough to put a chastity belt on a dragon.
Yes.
And then you could stab him. If you're close enough to put a chastity belt on him, I think you would have been able to stab him to begin with, right?
Well, I think so, yeah. it makes them docile. I don't know. It must be pheromones or something on it. But you know, spearing them, you know, St. George is depicted running a dragon through with his spear. St. Michael, who's another dragon slayer, he chops their head off with a great big sword. Some of them are quite bizarre. One of them involved feeding them with sheep that had been filled with inflammable substances, and as the dragon ate it, its own flames set alight to the inflammable substances, so it exploded, which is a bit gory. And some of the other ones involved wrapping barbed wire all around the sheep, and the dragon would eat it and gulp it down and then get the barbed wire caught in its throat. And while it was choking to death, then you ran up with your merry men and hacked it to pieces.
See, folks, when we didn't have social media and cell phones, people were encouraged to use their imagination.
Well, they were.
Because you don't hear this kind of creative thinking anymore, but that's, wow.
Yeah.
Funny that they're like, oh, it's so matter of fact in the telling, right?
Oh, yeah. And this is the way you do it. Oh, right. Oh, fine. I mean, my favorite one, which goes back to my book on the weird wolves, is there is a headland of rock at a town called Filey. It's called Filey Brigg, and it sticks about a mile into the sea. And the legend was that these rocks are actually the bones of a dragon. And the story is the dragon was doing its normal stuff, flying around, burning people, setting fire to buildings, and generally being a nuisance.
As dragons do, right?
As dragons do. And of course, everybody, they're always have a reputation for being greedy and having a huge appetite. And so they put out a huge pile of a Yorkshire delicacy called parkin. It's P-A-R-K-I-N, which is kind of a treacly toffee cake. It's actually very nice. And when I was a student, I more or less lived on it, as there was a shop just nearby where I lived that used to produce large plates of the stuff. Anyway, but it's very sticky, this stuff. It's the kind of pudding that gets stuck between your teeth. And when you've had it, it's a bit like a toffee. And you sort of, you find that you are sucking your teeth, trying to get it out because you know you've got it stuck there. Anyway, this dragon snarfed down this huge bowl of parkin and found its jaws were stuck together. So it headed off into the sea to drink up seawater to try and wash it all away. And while it had its head in the water, the locals crept up and chopped its head off and killed it.
All right. Well, it seems like a convoluted long version to get to it, but the end result is what counts, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. So, yes.
All right. I've got to ask you something. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so, you know, to add to your dragon slaying skills, bakery. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Obviously, you have to be well-rounded to deal with all forms of mythical beasts.
Yes.
One of the topics in your book is, and Tim, I hope you're paying attention, zombies. Zombies, Charles, talk to us about the claims of zombies. I need to know more about that.
Right. Well, this stems from a chronicler called William of Newburgh. And he was born in the Wold Newton Triangle area and was at a priory in the area and then moved a few miles away to another priory called Newburgh, where he wrote spent the rest of his life there as a monk, and he wrote lots of history books. But intriguingly, in his history books, along with quite detailed and accurate tales of what was going on in politics and European history and the Crusades. So, you know, we're talking proper stuff here. He has little tales that he says are sort of almost warnings to the curious about things he knows are true and he's heard from so many people they must be true. And he has tales about encounters with fairies. He has tales about what we would call zombies, although some of them they verge over into the element of being vampires. And you know,
does he have any tales of robots coming to life and trying to murder people?
No, he doesn't. We don't have any robots.
No sentient AI robots, but zombies, Tim. I'm just making sure you're aware of that.
But you talked right over him when he said they don't have any robots there. So
right, exactly. So I'm just saying, zombies most likely more real than sentient robots trying to kill us, Tim. I'm just saying.
No, you're skipping over the end of the story. go on, sir. Go on.
Yeah, no. I mean, actually, think when you say about it, had a zombie been in a suit of armor, then it would actually look like a killer robot, wouldn't it, when you think about it?
Very similar. Yes, it would. Thank you.
Yeah, but still, zombie in charge.
Zombies. And these are creatures that arise from the tomb, and they generally are a nuisance to society, not least one of them that came back from the tomb and climbed into bed with his widowed wife, and promptly wanted to resume marital relations with her, which didn't go down too well. And these zombies, what they called them, revenants in those days, and it was a belief that it was a body that was reanimated and had come back from the dead. And they were a nuisance. They spread disease. Plague would follow. Lots of people would die. And eventually, you know, some brave heroes would get together and trace the zombie to its tomb, open the tomb and find that the body was there on a morning and it was bloated, look for all purposes as if it was still lifelike and still alive, and there might be blood showing around it, and parts of it showed signs that were still growing, you know, fingernails were growing and so on. And so they would then behead it and cut out its heart and then burn it on a pyre, and that would end the career of the zombie. And it was a serious concern that they had. And it's, you know, again, we know that the body rotting in a tomb can go through various post-mortem changes, including swelling up, sloughing off some of the outer skin, so the pink skin underneath is showing there. Blood can appear. They can also groan and make, you know, as their gases are escaping. If you don't bury the bodies properly, not deep enough, and it's in loose soil, then the bloating corpse can actually reappear above the surface. So there's lots of explanations for it, which again wouldn't have been available to people at the time. But I say, interestingly, in the Wold-Newton Triangle, there is a village called Warham Percy, an abandoned medieval village where there's been a very long-term archaeological dig there of the church and the surrounding area. And they found that when they were going through the bodies buried in the church and around the church, that 10 of them showed signs of having been mutilated at death, and so that their heads had been cut off or their legs had been broken. And it was a very real belief, and again, we're going back to quite a logical thought process here. How do you stop the dead walking? Well, if you break their legs or even chop their legs off, they're not going to be able to walk. And if you chop their head off as well, then they're not going to be able to see where they're walking either. The way they dealt with it, you chop the head off and you put the head between their legs. So they wouldn't even be able to find it with their arms because they wouldn't know where their head was. So it's quite a logical in medieval thought process approach to it. But, you know, here's this village where, sleepy little village, a farming village, where people thought at least 10 of their neighbors might come back from the dead, and that they needed to destroy, dismember the bodies to prevent them from doing that. Mm. And I say, this chronicler talks about this and has stories from all over England of places being plagued by these revenants, these creatures that have come back from the tomb and are undead and have to be destroyed. And I say, intriguingly, some of them, their characteristics are like are those of a zombie, rather mindless and shambling around, whereas other ones seem a bit more like a vampire. But I say, again, it was one of those things that you thought, who knew this strange, sleepy area gave birth to zombie stories 800 years, 900 years before, you know, anybody else came up with The Walking Dead. So, you know, it was just intriguing. And the icing on the cake was there was a church where they were burying bodies that had been preemptively dealt with so that they wouldn't walk.
Yeah, right. I mean, I wonder if that's what cremation, you know, kind of stemmed from, was making sure that the dead could not come back.
Mm.
You know, I wonder if there's elements of that to that version of history.
Well, I mean, it's noticeable that in all these zombie tales, it usually ends with the body not only being dismembered, but then burnt, so there's nothing left of it.
Right.
And So it's definitely not going to come back. Because, I mean, again, the medieval mind was quite simplistic, and the idea of coming back from when Day of Judgment came and you all came back from the tomb, the view was that you would actually pop out of your tomb as a body as you were before. And the way the churches were laid out and graves were laid out, the parishioners were always laid out with their feet facing towards the east, so that they would pop up out of their tomb, stand up almost, facing the east, which was where the end of days was going to be, because the east was the Holy Land, the east was Jerusalem, the east was where the Garden of Eden was, and so on. And again, you get tales of people who were wicked, thought to be wicked, people would bury them face down. So again, when came to Judgment Day and you were going to be coming out of your tomb, you wouldn't be able to do it because you'd be pointing the wrong direction.
For me, that would be a problem. Without GPS, I have a trouble getting down my driveway. So, yeah, if they planted me in the wrong direction, I'm wobbling, probably more looking for a McRib sandwich than the heavenly host. In this area, there's so many strange things. I mean, do you have other creature sightings, UFO sightings, ghostly sightings that all kind of emanate from that same area?
There's a few ghost sightings. Nothing that spectacular, though it was actually one of those that first set me writing about it, because we were, as a child, I was coming home in the family car one day, and we went past a semi-derelict building, which is still there, and it's interestingly that no matter who owns this building, they can't make a commercial success of it. You know, they try to open it as cafes, as a pub, all sorts of things. It always fails. And my mother happened to mention that during the Second World War, the house had a reputation, such a bad reputation for being haunted, that convoys of carrying essential war materials were allowed to make a long detour to avoid going along that road, which is one of the things that, you know, again, it strikes you as unusual. You know, there we were, this is World War II, fighting for survival. There was rationing, petrol was rationed because it had to be shipped in across the Atlantic against the U-boats, and yet somebody thought this tale of a haunted house was so serious that they gave official permission for people to run up a few extra miles and go a long way around to deliver goods. So, yeah, there's ghosts. There's a whole mass of eccentric people around there, which is a whole tale for another day. I mean, these are just normal people who are a bit bonkers. There are some UFO reports, but quite a lot for a remote area, because there's also ley lines running through it. And a lot of people believe that UFOs and ley lines tend to be associated, and that the UFOs follow the ley lines. But, you know, on the other hand, the area has early warning radar systems and a lot of military aircraft on maneuvers around there. So, you know, quite a lot of the reports of UFOs can be explained away, that there is a rational explanation for them. They say there's UFOs, and my favorite part is there is this enormous monolith, big, large stone slab, which is taller than any of the stones in Stonehenge, and when it was first erected, would have actually been substantially taller than the one you've seen now. And this seems to be at the center of all this weirdness. And so it was clearly, you're going back 4,000 years when this stone was erected. And the type of stone it is meant it had been dragged a very, very long way. It wasn't a local piece of stone. This is at the center of all this area. And, you know, there was clearly 4,000 years ago, this area had some kind of ritual significance to the people of the area. And there are a huge number of burial mounds, barrows in the area, far more than you'd expect from an area as remote as this. So the suggestion is people were wanting to be buried in this area, again, you know, leading up to the fact it had some ritual significance. And it's this ritual significance, I think, is why the traditions have grown up around it. There's something people think is magical about the place, that it's unusual about the place. And that, you know, is it chicken or egg? Was the barrow there, and was the monolith there, and did it assume this ritual significance because there was magic in the area, or have later generations attributed magic to the fact that there was this huge monolith there and this long, long tradition associated with it? So I say it is a fascinating area.
Now, like Bridgewater Triangle, Bermuda Triangle, other triangles that pop up, are there mysterious disappearances in that area as well?
Not particularly mysterious disappearances. I mean, obviously people do disappear, but no, that's not really been an issue. There is, and I'm looking into it now, a suggestion that there is a particular deep cave in one of the sea cliffs along there that has mysterious properties and people can disappear. I think that may well be more that it is actually quite dangerous, and if you get trapped there, you're going to get drowned and washed out to sea. But it was used by, this is not in the book, this is new material I'm currently looking at, but it was used by smugglers to stash away stuff. It's one of those places that's only available, you can only accessible for about an hour a day on each tide. And so it would have been a mysterious place. And obviously smugglers are great ones for spreading rumors of, you know, ghosts and ghoulies and
right.
things, so that when they're out doing their nefarious deeds, moving contraband around, nobody, you know, the first view is, oh, it's the ghost, rather than that's our next door neighbor smuggling brandy in. So, you know, keep it secret and add a bit of mystique to it. I mean, it sounds like something from Scooby-Doo, really, where it always turns out it's a criminal in disguise as a ghost rather than
right. Scooby-Doo
ghost.
Taught us the most important thing, that the things to really be afraid of are people, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there's that element of it. And this whole area is known for lots of rather remote coves that are ideal places if you're a smuggler for landing material there and being dangerous places if you're an excise man looking to apprehend smugglers. So there is that element, but there's no disappearances or abductions as such.
Now you look at this obviously through the lens of skeptical optimism, right? I mean, the possibilities.
Yeah.
There's interesting stories. Are there any that do lead you down the path of true unusual phenomena, not something that could be dismissed by just folklore or fairy tales?
Well, I mean, the ghost stories, certainly. this house I mentioned, that is such a long tradition and seems to have been there for so long. You think, well, there must be something in it to do with it. You know, and the tales where we started with the screaming skull, and the fact that whenever it was disturbed, chaos would ensue. All of these do leave you to think. You know, we can be skeptical, or we can find logical explanations for a lot of the stuff that's going on there, but there's other stuff that still leaves you scratching your head, thinking, well, how quite did that happen, and where did that tale come from? You know, that Flamborough Head, which is one of the places that's got, you know, various ghost stories attached to it that have run for, you know, hundreds of years. You know, it's clearly not a mass delusion or social media. It's not something that sprung up in modern times. It's a long old tradition. So I think there are these things in there that we just don't know about. And you know, as I said, you know, some of these things, there's a lot we still don't know about the world we live in. And the more we learn, the more we realize there's stuff we don't understand. You know, I mean, this whole element of quantum physics and stuff, which is, you know, way over my head. I was a complete duffer at science at school. You know, that there are more dimensions than we know about. You start wondering, well, are there connections here? You know, are we? I think the analogy I've seen, it's like you're living in an apartment block, and you're on one floor, and you can see everything, but the people in the floor above, you never see, but you can hear them. And the people in the floor right below, you never see, but you can hear them. But, you know, are ghosts and UFOs the same thing? You know, that they're in a slightly different dimension to our dimension. And just occasionally we cross over and encounter them. And, you know, indeed, all the tales of fairy folk, they have a similar thing, that they are living in the other world, which is sort of a parallel world to ours. And at certain times and in certain places, there's a crossover, and we have encounters between us humans and them, the fae, or ghosts or whatever. But I say, I think that is one of those mysteries which in the years to come, people will get a bit more of a handle on. That, you know, it's not just bunkum. There is actually, if you like, a scientific explanation. It's some kind of, we're living in almost a multiverse. And, you know, these other creatures are in this parallel world to us.
I'm curious, in a place like Wald where there's just strange stories and everything, have you ever looked to see, like, what the opposite side of the world, where does it land? And is there similar folklore and legend there, almost like an energy pass-through?
I have to say, I haven't. That's a very good idea.
It would be interesting to see, right? I mean, yeah. Is there an opposite reaction or a polar different side to this entire existence? I don't know. I just crossed my head as we're talking about it. And I wonder if in these places where legends and lores are so strong, does it continue through?
Yeah. I mean, I think if we sort of drill a hole through the earth to the other side, we'd actually be probably coming out somewhere like Australia, which of course has its own huge through the native population traditions and folklores and mysteries, but also has an awful lot of empty desert, so might not be so fruitful. But it's an intriguing prospect to say that the monolith I was mentioning, it's the Rudston monolith, that is at the end of a ley line which runs right across the country down to the south coast and also crosses the Great St. Michael, St. Mary ley line, which runs from, actually not very far from where I am now on the east coast, across to Land's End. And you know, you add that in, and again, is this a coincidence? Are we drawing lines on maps and drawing conclusions after the event, or is there a significant element there? You know, it just seems a bit of a coincidence that the center of the world Newton triangle and the center of all the general weirdness that happens there happens to be at the end of a major ley line in the country. So, you know, I think we are, you know, with it being a sacred landscape, which you can say is an archaeological fact, is there also on an Earth Mysteries front a significance there as well?
That's the fun of living, right? Is exploring and investigating and looking into the mysteries that surround us. And even if we find that there's no true element to these stories, the idea of why people believe them or where these stories are spitting.
Definitely.
Very good stuff. Well, the book is out and available. We've got a link to it on today's program guide. Charles, thank you so much. We'd love to have you come back and share more strange stories. So when you've got another book burning, let us know, and we'd love to have you back.
I will do indeed. I appreciate that.
Remember to get the book, folks, and check it out, Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, and rate and review the books as well. That definitely helps.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, we know that. We're always pushing for people to check that out. Thank you all for tuning in. We will be back tomorrow. We've got a special edition audio of tonight's live video broadcast. That's right. Tonight we're doing another Darkness Radio Live, Holzer's Ghosts. It is a look at the strange case of Bishop Pike. Mark Anthony, my guest, we're going to talk about this wonderful, amazing case, one that we never covered on the TV series, The Holzer Files, but it is a fascinating case that I wanted to dig deeply into. So we're doing that live tonight, 9 p.m. Central. That's 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. I hope you guys will check it out on our Darkness Radio YouTube page or on our social media. Be a part of it. Ask questions. For those of you that listen to the podcast, you'll hear that audio tomorrow right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.